So, hello and welcome to the Logistics Podcast. Today, with our co-host Tobias.
Good evening.
And special guests, and that's the reason why we talk English. Welcome, Lynn Fritz.
Good evening to both of you and to the audience as well. Thank you.
So, Lynn, thanks for joining us. You are here participating in the recording from California. You said it's morning at your side, so we are in the evening as always.
Yeah.
I want to give a short introduction to the audience who you are. So you were born in 1942 in San Francisco. You are the son or were the son of a logistics entrepreneur. In 1967, you graduated with a Juris Doctor from Lincoln University School of Law and joined the family business, the Fritz Companies. The Fritz Companies, you did an IPO, initial public offering, in 1992, brought the company to the stock market, and you sold the Fritz Companies to UPS in 2001, if that's right. After you sold the company, you did something very interesting. You founded the Linco Supply Chain Solutions and the Fritz Institute. We want to talk about today.
Right.
You mentioned it in the pre-talks, so we have a lot of awards and a lot of awards that recognize your achievements. So I just want to talk about two shortly: the Citizen Diplomat Award from the International Diplomacy Council, and the Californian Prize for Service and Common Good from the University of San Francisco. And you mentioned you had different roles, for example, in the university board in Columbia. What did you tell me?
At Georgetown University.
Georgetown University as well. So you live a long life with a lot of achievements. And today we want to talk about the Fritz Institute. You founded, you and your wife founded. The Fritz Institute has a mission to innovate solutions and facilitate adaption of best practice for rapid and effective disaster response and recovery in communities around the world. So, Lynn, when you and your wife founded the Fritz Institute, you had in mind transferring professional logistics know-how to humanitarian organizations. What motivated you to do so?
Well, as you said, I ran Fritz Companies for many years, and that got to be, we had 11,000 people around the world in over 100 countries. And over the course of all those years, I mean, I saw often that there were either disasters or famines or slow-moving or fast-moving things that impacted the civic situations around our offices, our staff, and our people. And I found to my chagrin that almost 8 out of 10 times we had to get involved ourselves to support the families and the rest of our personnel. We couldn't wait for the local municipalities or for other organizations or NGOs to do that, because it was never seemingly very coordinated or very effective, or at least it was not effective to the point that I was concerned about for my, for my people and my people's family and their family. So so my motivation, when I looked to sell the company was to say, this is obviously an underserved element here, it would appear to me from the outside. And I should look into it as best I can to see if really my practical skills that I developed over the last 35 or 40 years and sort of being in many ways the architect of modern logistics, as I'm often called, which is very nice, but very definitely involved in that. And which is really how my wife got involved, because she's a business professor. And I asked her and five other professors around the world to come and actually make a study of the efficacy, generally operational efficacy, of the larger humanitarian organizations, from the UN organizations to Red Cross to various NGOs. They did a long work on that, and it was obvious to me that there were some very, very distinct operational limitations, I would call it, you know, to the effective operation of humanitarian aid. And I could spend hours on this one because I do lecture about this around the world. But that was what so the motivation was to say, well, why don't we, as knowing what I know and having the resources that I have, really apply the same to assist, not to do it ourselves, not to make another thing, but to assist all of the remarkable organizations that do this, and to see if we can't raise the level of their efficacy through support from us. And that was the motivation that we had, and the motivation to also, to be very frank, to raise the level of understanding within those organizations of the importance of logistics. One small footnote: when I started in logistics, and one reason I get some awards or some recognition is it was very fragmented, low level understanding or within the commercial world. If you or Tobias were in, you know, well educated, and you said, I want to go into shipping, they'd say, well, it's a nice thing. You know, plumbing is a good thing. It's functional. We need this stuff like this, but it's, you guys are made for more. Journalism, something that really is a profession. And it wasn't considered a profession when I started. It was a function, a nice, important one. But I saw the same thing after 30 or 40 years of raising the understanding of and appreciation of logistics. That wasn't even a word when I started. It was shipping and transport. It wasn't logistics. Supply chain was not a word that was ever used years ago when I began. And so this, I wanted to really raise the understanding of and appreciation also within their organizations of logistics. So because you can't really do much about efficacy if there isn't enough focus and awareness within the organization of its importance. Those are the motivations.
Okay, thanks. So you recognize the importance and the function of logistics in the business world. You Yes. recognize there's a gap in the humanitarian support in logistics. What role does logistics play in the humanitarian aid?
It's crucial. It's a crucial role. It's ironic in a way how crucial it is and how underappreciated it generally is, underappreciated in putting the time, effort, money, and resources to refining the process of it. Logistics, for instance, I mean, just as a small note, that was a word that I took when I went public. I wanted to show that there was this continuity or integrated thing to logistics. It wasn't just shipping and air freight and ocean freight and boxes and parcels. It was all a continuity of things together. Logistics was a very old word that was always by the military, for 300 years. And the reason I'm bringing it up is only because the military always understood logistics, either you win or you lose. This is crucial. I don't care how many guns you have or brave fighters, if you don't have the support, militaries throughout the ages understood this. I bring that up because, again, in commercial, though, it was really underestimated until the last 25 or so years as supply chain and things really became a critical, integral, and strategic part of most organizations' life, and therefore they put money. When 2001, when I went into the humanitarian area, it was still in a very, I would call it, regressed appreciation state. Let me just put it that way.
Okay, thanks. So, yes, I mean, from the business perspective, everybody understands it. In the humanitarian aid, the first thoughts are more about being human and being helpless and being supportive, and not about efficiency and effectiveness. Those words are too hard for the aid.
Precisely. It's crisis, it's reaction, everybody and the people that do this are so well intended and they're so brave and they do such good work. I mean, that was the other thing that really bothered me, that these people were doing such work and such sacrifice often in themselves, and you know they weren't anywhere near as effective, and so many more hours were spent with problems that were avoidable. And so more beneficiaries could have been, and the coordination, et cetera, et cetera. So, and my whole life is in the operating field. I mean, I'm not down there. I'm not up, you know, making big speeches. I'm always down with the people and the rest that actually have to do it. I love it, frankly. And I love the people that are engaged in that. So, it's been a lifetime thing for me. And so this was a very easy and spiritual almost transition to say, oh goodness, yes, I can, I think I can make a difference here. And it's a difference that ought to be made. My only surprise I thought there, when I really did the research, that there would be all kinds of commercial operations and companies and things that would really be engaged in this in a very real way. You know, I didn't think we're one of the only people. We're very unique. And I was shocked and sad, frankly, because I was hoping to put together an easy network, perhaps, you know, of organizations, commercial organizations, other types of organizations that were involved in some way or another, and we could coalesce their activities in a way that it could just be supportive of the humanitarian sector organizations that were doing this work. Was that was shocking too, a little bit, how unique this effort was when it started, actually.
I mean, by founding the Fritz Institute, you answered this challenge very systematically. I understood. You are active in three fields. That's action to support humanitarian organizations, leadership and knowledge management, training to build up supply chain capacities, and research to improve the methodologies. So you even gave it a more systematic approach by manifesting those research activities. How does the Institute work on a daily basis?
Well, in those three fields, let me just give you a little data, you know, around them. And, one was just simple education and understanding of logistics and what supply chain would be for because by the way, I mean, in the humanitarian field, logistics is a very dynamic thing. When I worked in the commercial area, it was all to do predictability. We need so much. It's going to be there at certain times. Everything was good. I mean, here, you don't know where something's going to happen. You don't know the circumstances on the ground of, you know, what happens, et cetera. So the dynamics within are difficult. So what I saw was that there was not really any educational tools that I could find, and I looked for them. Courses, study, organizations that did. So we began our own course of education electronically, and we did this with the community. It was with all of the organizations. It wasn't just with us saying we know what we're doing. We went and worked tirelessly, and so did all. This is from UN, Red Cross, Mission Sans Frontières, Save the Children, CARES, all of the notable organizations that wanted to get better, helped us help themselves by cooperating and collaborating on a certification course of humanitarian logistics. The word was never used before we used this, interestingly. I mean, they never put the two words together. The people in the field, well, we're logistics, we're, you know, sort of, we do stuff, and they do stuff. Like, it was very similar to what it was when I began, when we're called transportation and traffic people and things, obscure names. They're very functional, and that's the way that most of the these wonderful people that were doing three jobs at the same time, one of them happened to be doing logistics. Anyhow, we thought it was urgent, number one, to see what we could do to orchestrate a learning methodology that would be common to all. It wasn't just, this could be applied anywhere and was very unique and could be done on the ground, people in the field. They didn't have to come to classrooms. So we did this originally off the field, and now we can do it digitally as we progress. We've created a software. There was never ever a software that was adapted to the field and adopted by the field. Everybody had their own pieces of software or different things they did to support. So we definitely took that on, made something called Helios, et cetera. We've used the research to do what we think are the best and most important KPIs. When I say we, it's Fritz Institute with the collaboration of our partners. Say, we'll do the work. You just make sure that what we're doing, you all agree, should be the basic KPI so that we can, correlate this. So we do the research, we do standards of performance. We get retained by different organizations to check their own efficacy next to, others, et cetera. So all to basically raise the standards, the methodologies, the resources. And so that's sort of how we work on a day-to-day basis.
Okay, so did you establish, or do you think you established like a platform allowing those organizations to talk and to align on certain standards, or was there something before like this, or is it the first time?
No, there wasn't. There was absolutely none. Every organization did their own. This sounds like nobody's really been paying attention to this, but there are really all kinds of reasons that where we found the state of the state. One is that they're all donor or organizer. They're all there because donors are giving them money to do a certain thing, and so they have a certain amount of money to do it. They have it's one by one. It doesn't really allow for a broad collaborative kind of process, and that's why we felt we could be really of some importance here, because we had the time and the money, to do this. I mean, I basically funded this myself for many years because I believed in it so much, and I wanted to show and demonstrate really to the world or to themselves that this could really be an effective thing to do before we ever reached out for anybody else to fund us. Now we're 100% funded by USAID, DFIDS, and the rest of it. Before, it was totally funded by myself, and I wanted it that way until I thought I could prove to somebody that this will actually be effective and would be worth investing in. Because it was hard to see that right at the beginning. So it was a bit of a hard, interestingly, difficult sale when we began.
Yeah, I think so. From the business perspective, we are used to build 100,000 of square feet of warehouses and establish a functioning, steady process. And now you're entering a field where even the funding is based on a catastrophe in many ways, because only people are funding and giving donations when they see an urgent need, and not for building up a background structure and helping to train somebody to be ready in a year or something. Or
you could not have said that better. That's exactly correct. And that's why it's really been difficult for these organizations to operate effectively, like you say. I mean, they have the thing in Turkey, the reason one of them, I mean, of course, there's the warehouses there. Everything's broken. The roads are broken. There's, and people are flooding in, and it's very, very difficult. But you couldn't have summed that up better. Thank you.
Okay, so when we met in Berlin last year, we met there for the Logistics Hall of Fame Gala, where you support, or where you awarded the Lindsay Fritz Medal you funded for giving a stage to special achievements, to excellent achievements in the humanitarian field.
Humanitarian logistics field.
Why do you think such an award is useful? What is the purpose of it?
For the same reason I mentioned a little bit earlier here in the interview. I thought for years, because of the experience, some of which I've just related, that great practices have to be recognized. Because every organization has their own practices, they use their own resources, and if we can showcase excellence here, it will hopefully spring excellence and wanting to be excellent by other organizations as well, and bring the awareness of the crucial nature of humanitarian logistics up to the fore. And so I've been looking for some years to have such a prize, but I wanted to make sure that the Fritz Institute was established enough as this key organization that does this, that it would have the imprimatur to really want that, and to have organizations desire to do it, and to come forward with their practices. And I think and that is my entire intention. I'm delighted. This is our first year of doing it. I'm delighted to meet you there and to see the IMC, who was the winner of that International Medical Corps, who was the very deserved winner. And as I think this is a competitive thing, which is also what I wanted. I wanted organizations to compete, to put in and apply for this award, and to have it measured by a third party, which the Hall of Fame group and the rest do. It's not measured by ourselves. This is, I'm saying, hey, now you, let's have a very, very objective third party going through the process of one to the other, to all of the applicants, and having a consensus as to who should be, because there will only be one winner a year at this point, or at least. And so I wanted it to be a hard process, because I knew the harder the process and the more effort we put in to be able to attain the award, the more important it would be, and the more prestigious the holder of that award would be as well. So that is the basic background, and hopefully the intention and the longer term intention of the award itself, which is I have great expectations for, and I'm honored, privileged to sort of be at the center of that. It's humbling and pleasing at the same time.
And for me, listening to what you just discussed about, it's some kind of doing the hard things first makes it quite profitable in the process afterwards. So when I'm listening to you, what you just said, it's like let's try to make things more efficient, maybe faster, to provide more aid for those who need it very fast. And to not throw a bunch of money on things to help, and spare out the efficiency. So I really like the idea what you just told to make it even harder to receive this award in the Hall of Fame. So it's very interesting. So you were talking about software. We had the IMC also in our podcast. They were talking about their system. What do you think? Why does it help global humanitarian organizations? How do you support those organizations with your institute regarding the software development?
We made a software called Helios, which is an open source software that we made in context, this is some years ago now, in our effort, and this was actually, this was an expensive thing for us to do and a really a difficult thing, but we created a very nice software to do it. The most important long-term effect, though, Tobias, to me, was the fact that it engendered more and more interest and capacity with these other organizations to do more themselves, to either collaborate with us on this and the rest, so that there really were a higher consciousness of what technologies could be done and to apply within their own organizations. This IMC software that they did is it's fabulous. It's not good. I mean, it's good on any standard. This is like just on a basis of a humanitarian sector standard, on a commercial standard. And I think they may sell and display this software to be able to make more money for themselves, to get people encouraged to supply them. It was a consciousness. Again, it's just like you say, Tobias, it's all, what can you do at the lowest level and just to keep this growing and a methodology until it creates a infrastructure or a underpinning, that can support everything being, raised to a different level. If that answers your question,
Yeah, and it's perfect for the next question. As you just mentioned, you're trying to make hard things for people to reach, to get the award, to get the support behind the award. But there are quite a lot of institutions and organizations on the field of humanitarian aid. So I think the bigger ones are those like the Red Cross, United Nations, Medics Sans Frontières. When you're looking on this landscape of organizations, including the IMC and everything else we were not talking about, what is your take on this landscape? How do you think it will develop? It maybe will improve over the year. Is there something which connects all of them, or is there maybe some organization being bigger and better than others?
That's a very broad question. I don't know how long this podcast is, but I could give you about four or five answers to that, because it's a good question. Let me start by saying that most of the humanitarian organizations, large and small, started and continued with more or less one focus. Mission Sans Frontières has an obvious, very distinct, very unique, very discreet, focus. Save the Children has a very particular focus. UNHCR had a very particular focus. And this could go across very, very small, large, worldwide, or very, very local organizations. And so they all do their part. And then you have countless organizations in every country. Some of them are real formal and large and important. Others are just simply community organizations that are involved in helping people in their community. And when the blank hits the fan or a disaster occurs and the rest, and these organizations, come to the fore because they're familiar, with the local things on the ground. And so the Fritz Award and the landscape in general is not just to support the larger, more known organizations, but one would be to hopefully give visibility to smaller ones and who are maybe not doing things of global significance, but a very unique application of how to work on the ground. Because when we talk about the landscape, it's a very interesting word to use, actually, because the almost every big organization works with people within the local area every time. They don't usually just send 1,000 people over to Turkey or 1,000 people to Rwanda. You know, they are trying to work with some local established organizations, people, authorities, you know, et cetera. And so one of my longer term goals for the Fritz Institute, you know, is to buttress, you know, the and acknowledge the abilities of the local populations to support this effectiveness, just effective in aid. And it doesn't necessarily mean to be disaster. It could be drought. It just could be water quality. You know, all these things are going on all the time. And so you have the people at the site, and then you have the landscape of the international organizations that, you know, put a supporting and financial role to it. And they both have to be better coordinated, and they work at it all the time. And we work at it all the time. We always come from the bottom up before we go from the top down. I mean, it's just been the history of my life. I like it this way, frankly, because I don't know any other way of doing it. I've just never been smart enough to say from some kind of, you know, large thing how the world should work. No matter, you know, for all the rather obvious reasons. But this is a really a particular good application of that sort of ethos, I would say.
So if our audience consisting of logistics people and related people are also enthusiastic about bringing efficiency to NGOs, so what would you recommend? How could someone in the business field support those ideas?
The way that I've seen it most effective, you know, over the last, you know, 20, you know, some odd years, is to go, you know, sort of through us too, just to say, again, how can I be, you know, I have an interest, I have an ability, a reason, whatever that they have that they wish to support. It's very hard. It's hard to find an organization or to have an organization just say, yes, help me. It's a cultural thing. Sort of hard to explain that it would be hard for just most logistics companies or individuals to find a place, you know, within the theater and within this landscape, whether it's in the larger, you know, global ones or the rest. And it's not just the Fritz Institute, because we collaborate and we have something called CAG, which is this executive group of all with the leaders of logistics and supply chain within organizations throughout the world, which we do all of our collaboration with, because we've never done anything just on our own. We've always, as I mentioned a number of different times. So we're in a unique way of saying, if this organization's, then we would send it over to our collaborative group and say, can this be helpful? How can this? And we do this all the time. We do this all the time from individuals, from academics, I might add. You know, one thing that is happening that you haven't asked about, but it's very important to me, and I think to the mission of the Institute and the mission of a better humanitarian logistics, is the academic theater. You know, prior to 2000, you know, there was almost no academic research programs, curriculums around humanitarian logistics. There just wasn't, because it wasn't even sort of, and we've done a lot on this area. When I say we've generated a lot of interest and the rest on this. And down there are universities around the world, up to PhD programs that would give a degree in humanitarian logistics. The certification program, the one that we have, and we collaborate with universities around the world to work with them and to hopefully enable their research and their rest to be better and more acknowledged through that. And so whether it's on the academic level or the operation level, you know, from people in logistics that want to be helpful, you know, we're in a particularly unique way have a wherewithal, I should say, you know, to point them in the right direction, and we do this all the time.
So you also serve as an interface or like a cross connector.
Yes,
connecting the world.
Like a LinkedIn. Like, except we're not to LinkedIn. I mean, we do it one by one. You know, yeah. I don't want to say that, you know, we're getting, you know, 700 things a day and we're, you know, efficiently, you know, putting people together. It's that would be a total misunderstanding. We're busy as usual. What we do. We do this also. This is not something that we do for a living or something, because we focus almost entirely on what, you know, on the things that we discussed earlier. This is a extra thing, but I love doing it. I like because it's just a uniquely hard theater to get into, no matter how much you'd like, you know, you'd like to, you know, to do it. And the organizations themselves are hesitant often, you know, to work with commercial companies. You know, they have an understandable reluctance to say, or you're just using our brand, or you're trying to do this. You know, there's a unique cultural hesitation, which I think you could probably appreciate, to these organizations that are really want to show themselves as they are, objective humanitarian organizations, not some fawn for green, whatever you call it, you know, green swiping, or yeah. Having there's a hesitation, and we're somewhat able, obviously, because of who we are and what it is, to, you know, be a little more efficient and effective in that area.
I mean, it's the most they have to lose is trust in from the donation side, and so they have to protect everything related to their brand. And so I find it very fascinating that you recognize these circumstances and these special rules. They are different compared to the to the business area. And
the ethos is too. The ethos internally is just
okay.
180 degrees, and in almost every respect. So I mean, it's not just the brand; it's just the internal cultural elements are very distinct. Yeah,
quite a diplomatic task to connect those worlds. I think. So thank you for doing so, and thank you for explaining what the Fritz Institute does. So when we prepared the podcast, we saw your birth date, and so you were born 1942. You have 82 years of experience and also 82 years of life experience. And so I would take another point into the discussion. I mean, you have a profound view on logistics and on the how business works and on how humanitarian aid works and how the world works. So from your perspective, looking back eight decades, a very general question. So what's your point of view? Where is humanity heading?
From what
you experienced over the years and from what I think also where hopes and thoughts you thought we might develop to, and what is happening in the last 5 to 10 years?
Well, I think about this a fair amount, actually. I mean, different levels. If you want to be as broad as humanity, I would say that, you know, we've been in a humanity, I think, since about the, you know, 18th century, has been in a somewhat optimistic humanism, you know, from Kant to the rest, a opportunity, optimistic, you know, learning, the individual, science, and good sense, and doing things that are positive, with a sense of positive outcome. In general, what I do see, you know, in the last number of years here is somewhat now much more fear-based, much more tribal. Let's protect what we have, protect us, protect borders, protect our, protect enemy, you know, dark, where, you know, at least 100 years of global trade, open borders, all the things that you know in logistics and the rest. If you saw logistics when I did, I mean, just getting across Europe was, well, I mean, that was too much for me. I mean, I want to stay in the States. I could actually go from one, you know, state to another without a lot of regulatory nonsense. And so you saw the borders going down. You saw essentially there was a trust element. It was going to be okay. You could trust the other partner. You had to work and nothing was easy. I don't mean to, you know, put a Pollyannish thing on this, but I saw it as a trust, optimism, you know, humans really saying we can make things better by working together and the rest and not being defensive. I have seen, you know, recently, humanity, sadly, in my estimation, taking a much different, you know, backward approach, sort of Middle Ages, you know, prior to that approach, since we're talking about humanity and in general terms, to a very pessimistic, extremely fear-based and isolating tribal viewpoint as opposed to the other. That would be my answer to that.
Thank you very much. So you were talking about your life, about what you did with the transportation company, and now what you're doing with the institute. So back in the 1980s, you started your own winery, your own vineyard. Was it some kind of hobby for you? Is there a passion, or what is the thing which fascinates you to do something more, which is also probably labeled with your company, your name, or whatever?
Yeah, well, it had nothing to do with my name. It was just really I saw wine as one of the unique vineyards. Let's just say. It's essentially a transformative product. That's always fascinated me, that you could take, you know, this vine and one that has been with us for the ages. This is nothing new about the vine, making of wine, the consumption of wine, both on a cultural, almost philosophical, you know, basis, and the rest, and to see and to witness and to be part of a process of sort of art and engineering is really fascinating. Humbling. I've always been into humbling things. It keeps me centered, and I think it keeps. And if you really witness, as I do, you know, the vineyard, we do all of our own grow. You know, we have all of our own vineyards. We make everything we do is self. Enclosed. There's no, we have no outside thing. It's 100% from beginning to end, even to the selling. And we have chefs there, and we, you know, because it's food and wine and the hearth and people coming together, you know, et cetera, over and above just the vine transforming into grape, transforming grape into wine and the rest, over and above the process of it. It's the social and cultural elements that are, I mean, it's most fascinating business. It's a smaller business, but by far, in some many ways, most fascinating business I've been in for more or less those reasons. I'd be happy to expound more if you like, because again, it's another favorite subject of mine, but that would, you know, sort of encapsulate it, I think.
Okay, so maybe we should do another episode about wine logistics, how to distribute wine in the U.S. Or...
I would be delighted to do that. It's a very interesting, the industry is going through some pretty interesting, you know, times, like almost every other, you know, industry, but it's a unique, it's a unique thing for that transformative factor, but again, also because it it brings people together and in a way that is very, very primordial. I mean, we want to be with friends, with family, with cohorts. We eat a fire. We're here by the hearth, and the fact that and if you ever get to, I hope I'd be happy to invite you both. I think I told Andreas to Winmar, our winery there one time, and you'll see it in a curious way. I think you'd enjoy the actual experience of it, not just the the quality of the wine and the rest of it. So that's what motivates me. Very similar, to the Fritz Institute and the Fritz companies before that, and the rest. What can we do to make things holistically better? It takes so much more work to do it that way. There's no doubt, but I mean, that's what I really like to do. That it's the only way I actually know how to do it too. So I'll. So that's my only methodology that I've been, somewhat successful on, and I like doing it. I appreciate having an opportunity to talk to you both about it, and to whatever your listeners may be as well. So thank you very much for the interview as well, gentlemen.
So thank you very much for this very interesting interview from our side. As you just mentioned, there is no better way to say it. Just like you said it before, you're trying, you're getting into things, doing the hard work to get to this synonym again, and try to make things better, try to make an impact. So for every guest, we have a last question, and of course we want to ask you this last question as well, which is some kind of recommendation for the audience. So is there like a book, a film, a special experience you made, or any other source which gave you the inspiration over the years to go your way, just like you did? Is there something you might recommend to our audience?
Yeah, I think the book and theory that has been most impressive to me from my lifetime is Lao Tzu and the Tao Te Ching. I think Lao Tzu had a 2500 BC, whatever. I'm sorry, 500 BC. 2500 years ago, I think had a it's a small book. It encapsulates also actually almost everything I've said today. If you read it, and it won't be a long read. But it really has you understand the world. When I say the world, I mean the cosmos and our small part in it, and how it works, and how you can work within and without it to be an individual and to be part of this cosmos in a way. And it all has to do with he likes water because water is very powerful. Why is water powerful? Because if it hits something, it goes around it. It doesn't, but over a long period of time, the river is made and the rest of it, but you're just simply, working within, the elements. And that's just one of countless, methodologies and thoughtful awareness of the human within the cosmos and world. It's very helpful. I think it's a superb thing. That would be my number one recommendation.
Okay, thank you very much. So we of course put it into our show notes so people can find it on the internet and yes, have a short read as a recommendation.
Yes. Yes.
So we are already at the end. It was very fast from my point of view. It was very interesting have someone in our podcast making this big impact in the field where he's an expert, where he wanted to have an impact. was yeah, I love listening to what you just told us in the podcast, and so thank you very much for your time, for attending here. It was a pleasure talking to you. Yeah,
well,
thank you very much.
Thank you both as well. I appreciate the opportunity. As I said, it's a favorite subject, but it's one that is not known as much as it should be. And so to be able to popularize this a bit, thus the, you know, the Lindsay Fritz Award was the same idea. And just simply to give this more breadth and scope as it should, and as the world hopefully will get better if this awareness and the practical application of these awarenesses are done. So I appreciate the opportunity, and nice to meet both of you. I know I've seen Andres. I hope to see you again, and thank you again for the interview.
Okay, thank you very much. We will do our part of making a small impact on the huge impact with our podcast. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much, gentlemen. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
Bye.